face. You prove yourself better and stronger. You do everything you can to outshine your opponent. And when do you determine which of us is shinier? I do not determine anything, Hector says. Stop asking questions. Do more. Stop collaborating. Before she can respond, he vanishes, leaving her standing alone in the sparkling light from the carousel. At first, the letters Marco receives from Isabel arrive frequently, but as the circus travels to far-flung cities and countries, weeks and sometimes months stretch wordlessly between each missive. When a new letter finally arrives, he does not even take off his coat before ripping open the envelope. He skims the opening pages that are filled with polite inquiries into his own days in London, remarks about how she misses the city, misses him. The goings-on of the circus are dutifully reported, but with such matter-of-fact precision that he cannot picture it in the richness of detail that he desires. She glazes over things she considers mundane, the travelling and the train, though Marco is certain they cannot be moving solely by train. The distance of the circus feels more pronounced, despite the tenuous contact through paper and ink. And there is so little about her. Isabel does not even inscribe her name upon the pages, referring to her in passing only as the illusionist, a precaution he advised himself and now regrets. He wants to know everything about her, how she spends her time when not performing, how she interacts with her audiences, how she takes her tea. He cannot bring himself to ask Isabel these things. When he writes her in return, he requests that she continue to write as often as possible. He emphasizes how much her letters mean to him. He takes the pages inscribed with her handwriting, descriptions of striped tents and star-speckled skies, and folds them into birds, letting them fly around the empty flat. It is so rare to have a new tent appear that Celia considers cancelling her performances entirely in order to spend the evening investigating it. Instead, she waits, executing her standard number of shows, finishing the last a few hours before dawn. Only then does she navigate her way through nearly empty pathways to find the latest addition to the circus. The sign proclaims something called the Ice Garden, and Celia smiles at the addendum below, which contains an apology for any thermal inconvenience. Despite the name, she is not prepared for what awaits her inside the tent. It is exactly what the sign described, but it is so much more than that. There are no stripes visible on the walls. Everything is sparkling and white. She cannot tell how far it stretches, the size of the tent obscured by cascading willows and twisting vines. The air itself is magical, crisp and sweet in her lungs as she breathes, sending a shiver down to her toes that is caused by more than the forewarn drop in temperature. There are no patrons in the tent as she explores, circling alone around trellises covered in pale roses and a softly bubbling, elaborately carved fountain. And everything, save for occasional lengths of white silk ribbons strung like garlands, is made of ice. Curious, Celia picks a frosted peony from its branch, the stem breaking easily. But the layered petals shatter, falling from her fingers to the ground, disappearing in the blades of ivory grass below. When she looks back at the branch, an identical bloom has already appeared. Celia cannot imagine how much power and skill it would take not only to construct such a thing, but to maintain it as well. And she longs to know how her opponent came up with the idea, aware that each perfectly structured topiary, every detail down to the stones that line the paths like pearls, must have been planned. It would be so taxing to manage something similar. She feels fatigued even considering it. She almost wishes her father were there, as she is beginning to understand why he had always been so adamant about building up her strength and control. Though she is not entirely certain, she wants to thank him for it. And she likes having the space to herself, the stillness and the calm sweetened with the subdued scent of frozen flowers. Celia remains in the ice garden long after the sun rises outside and the gates have been closed for the day. The circus arrives near London for the first visit in some time, and the afternoon before it opens, there is a knock on the door of Marco's flat. He opens the door only part way, holding it in place when he finds Isabel in the hallway. "You changed your locks," she says.
"Why did you not tell me you were coming?" Marco asks.
"I thought you might like the surprise," Isabel says.
Marco refuses to let her enter the flat, but he leaves her waiting in the hall for only moments before returning, bowler hat in hand. The afternoon is crisp but bright, and he takes her to tea.
"What is that?" Marco asks, glancing down at Isabel's wrist as they walk.
"Nothing," she says, pulling the cuff of her sleeve down to obscure his view of the bracelet, a carefully woven braid of her hair entwined with his.
He does not inquire further. Though Isabel never takes the bracelet off, it is gone when she returns to the circus that evening, vanished from her skin, as though it had never been there. Tasting. Lyon, September 1889. Herr Friedrich Thiessen is on holiday in France. He often goes on holiday in France in the autumn, as he is a great lover of wine. He picks a region and roams the countryside for a week, or perhaps two, visiting vineyards and collecting bottles of pleasing vintage to be shipped back to Munich. Herr Thiessen is friendly with several French winemakers and has made clocks for many of them. He visits one such winemaker on this particular trip to pay his respects and sample the latest bottles. Over a glass of Burgundy, the winemaker suggests that Friedrich might enjoy the circus that is in town, set up in a field a few miles away. A rather unusual circus, only open at night. But it is the clock, the elaborate black-and-white clock situated just inside the gates, that the winemaker thinks might particularly interest Herr Thiessen.
"Reminds me of your work," the winemaker says,
gesturing with his glass to the clock on the wall above the bar, shaped like a cascading bunch of grapes that tumble into a wine bottle that fills with wine as the hands on its label, an exact replica of the vineyard's label, tick by the seconds. Herr Thiessen is intrigued, and after an early dinner he puts on his hat and gloves and begins walking in the general direction his winemaker friend had indicated. It is not difficult to locate his destination, as several townspeople are walking in the same direction, and once they pass out of town and into the fields, the circus cannot be missed. It glows. That is Herr Friedrich Thiessen's first impression of Le Cirque des Rêves, seen from half a mile away and before he even knows its name. He walks toward it on this chilly evening through the French countryside like a moth to a flame. There is a considerable crowd outside where Herr Thiessen finally reaches the gates, and despite the crowd, he would have spotted his clock instantly, even without having been informed of its placement. It looms across from the ticket booth, just inside the large iron gates. It is about to strike 7 o'clock, and he stands back to watch it, letting the line for tickets pass in front of him as the harlequin juggler pulls out a 7th ball from thin air, as the dragon's tail twitches and the clock chimes 7 quiet chimes, barely audible over the din of the circus. Herr Thiessen is pleased. The clock appears to be in perfect working order, and has obviously been well taken care of, despite being left out in the elements. He wonders if it might need a stronger varnish, and wishes he had been informed that it would be used out of doors when he was constructing it, though it looks none the worse for wear. He keeps his eyes on it as he waits in line, wondering if he should try to contact Mr. Barris about the matter, if he still has the London address in his files back in Munich. When it is his turn, he gives the posted amount of francs to the ticket seller, a young woman in a black dress and long white gloves, looking more prepared for an elegant evening at the opera than for a night selling tickets at a circus. As she pulls out a ticket, he inquires, first in French and then in English, when she does not catch his meaning,
if she might know whom he could contact about the clock. She does not reply, but her eyes light up when he identifies himself as the person responsible for its construction. She returns his francs with his ticket despite his protestations, and after rummaging through a small box, she produces a business card, which she hands him as well. Herr Thiessen thanks her, moving out of line and off to the side, inspecting the card. It is a high-quality card on heavy stock, a black background embossed with silver. Le Cirque des Rêves, Chandresh Christophe Lefebvre, proprietor. The back has an address in London. Herr Thiessen places it in his coat pocket, along with his ticket and his saved francs, and takes his first steps into the circus. He begins by simply wandering, casually investigating the odd home of his Wunschtraum clock. Perhaps because of the months he spent absorbed in working on the clock itself, the circus feels familiar, comfortable. The monochromatic color scheme, the endless circles of the pathways like clockworks. Herr Thiessen is amazed at how well his clock fits the circus, and how well the circus fits his clock. He enters only a fraction of the tents that first night, stopping to watch fire breathers and sword dancers, sampling a very fine Eiswein in a tent marked Drinkery, Mature Visitors Only. When he inquires about it, the bartender, the only person in the circus that Friedrich encounters who speaks when spoken to, albeit minimally, informs him that it is a Canadian wine and notes the vintage for him. By the time Herr Thiessen departs the circus, motivated solely by exhaustion, he is completely and utterly besotted. He attends twice more before returning to Munich, paying his admission in full both times. He writes a letter to Monsieur Lefebvre upon his return to thank him for giving his clock such a wondrous home and for the experience of the circus itself. He goes on at length about the mastery of it, and says he gathered there is no rhyme or reason to its itinerary, but expresses his hope that it will come to Germany. Some weeks later, he receives a letter from Monsieur Lefebvre's assistant, stating that Monsieur Lefebvre greatly appreciates Herr Thiessen's compliments, especially coming from such a talented artist. The letter speaks highly of the clock, and mentions that should there be any kind of problem with it, Herr Thiessen will be contacted immediately. The letter mentions nothing of the current location of the circus or anything about it coming to Germany, much to Herr Thiessen's disappointment. He thinks about the circus frequently, often as he works, and it begins to have an influence upon his work. Many of his new clocks are done in black and white, some with stripes, and many with scenes from the circus, tiny acrobats, miniature snow leopards, a fortune teller who lays out minuscule tarot cards on the hour. Though he fears he never does the circus justice in these clockwork tributes. Chaperoned. Cairo, November 1890. While the Murray twins are more or less allowed to run rampant around the hidden corners of what is often referred to as backstage, a sprawling mansion's worth of space dispersed into nooks and passageways where the occupants of the circus live their lives when they are not performing, if they wish to be out and about in the circus proper during performance hours, they must have a chaperone. They protest this rule loudly and often, but their father insists that these rules will stay in place until they are 8 years old, at the very least. Widget asks often if the 8 years counts if it is a combined total, in which case they already meet the criteria. They are repeatedly reminded that they must have some sort of structure to their nocturnal schedule, being the only children in a rather unconventional household. For now, they have a rotating company of chaperones, and tonight the illusionist is on twin supervising duty. She is not often assigned this role, though the twins are quite fond of her. But this evening, she has enough time to spare between performances to escort them for a while. None of the patrons recognize Celia without her top hat and black-and-white gown, even those who watched her perform earlier in the evening. If passers-by pay her any notice, it is only to wonder how the children at her heels ended up with such red hair when her own is so dark. Beyond that, she appears to be just a young woman in a blue coat, wandering the circus as any other patron might. They start in the ice garden, though the twins grow impatient with the leisurely pace that Celia prefers to take around the frozen trees. Before they have travelled halfway through the space, they are begging to ride the carousel instead. They argue over who will get to ride the griffin, but Widget relents when Celia tells them the story of the nine-tailed fox just behind it, which suddenly sounds much more appealing. As soon as they disembark, a second ride is requested. For the subsequent trip through the loops of silver clockwork and tunnels, they end up on a serpent and a rabbit, with no complaints to be heard. After the carousel rides, Widget wants something to eat, so they head for the courtyard. When Celia procures him a black-and-white striped paper bag of popcorn, he insists he wants caramel as well, and will not eat it plain. The vendor, dipping apples on sticks into dark, sticky caramel, obliges him, drizzling it over the top. Several patrons nearby request the same. Poppet claims she isn't hungry. She seems distracted. So as they walk down a quieter passage away from the courtyard, Celia asks if anything is bothering her.
"I don't want the nice lady to die,"
Poppet says, tugging gently at Celia's skirt. Celia stops walking, putting out a hand to keep Widget, who is oblivious to anything other than his popcorn, from continuing along in front of her.
"What do you mean, dearest?" she asks Poppet. "They're going to put her in the ground," Poppet explains. "I think that's sad."
"What nice lady?" Celia asks. Poppet scrunches up her face while she thinks.
"I don't know," she says. "They look the same."
"Poppet, sweetheart," Celia says, pulling the twins aside into an alcove and bending down to talk to her face to face. "Where is this lady in the ground? Where did you see her, I mean?"
"In the stars," Poppet says.
She stands on tiptoes as she points upward. Celia glances up at the star-filled sky, watching the moon disappear behind a cloud, before returning her attention to Poppet.
"Do you often see things in the stars?" she asks. "Only sometimes," Poppet says. "Widge sees things on people."
Celia turns to Widget, who is eating his caramel-drizzle popcorn in messy handfuls.
"You see things on people?" she asks him. "Sometimes," he mumbles through a mouthful.
"What kind of things?" Celia asks. Widget shrugs his shoulders.
"Places they've been," he says. "Stuff they've done."
He shoves another handful of sticky popcorn into his mouth.
"Interesting," Celia says.
The twins have told her a great many odd things before, but this seems like more than childish fancies. "Can you see anything on me?" she asks Widget. Widget squints at her while he chews his popcorn.
"Rooms that smell like powder and old clothes," he says. "A lady that cries all the time. A ghost man with a frilly shirt that follows you around, and..."
Widget stops suddenly, frowning.
"You made it go away," he says. "There's nothing there anymore. How did you do that?"
"Some things are not for you to see," Celia says. Widget pushes his lower lip out in an impressive pout, but it only lasts as long as it takes him to bring another fistful of popcorn to his mouth. Celia looks from the twins back in the direction of the courtyard, where the light from the bonfire gleams along the edges of the tents, casting dancing shadows of patrons across the striped fabric. The bonfire never goes out. The flames never falter. Even when the circus moves, it is not extinguished, moved intact from location to location, smoldering the entire length of each train journey, safely contained in its iron cauldron. It has burnt steadily since the ceremonious lighting on opening night. And at the same moment, Celia remains certain, something was put in motion that impacted the entire circus and everyone within it once that fire was lit, including the newborn twins.
Widget, born just before midnight, at the end of an old day. Poppet, following moments later, in a new day, only just begun.
Poppet,
Celia says, turning her attention back to the little girl, who has been playing with the cuff of her jacket. If you see things in the stars that you think might be important, I want you to tell me about them. Do you understand?
Poppet nods solemnly,
clouds of red hair bobbing in waves. She leans in to ask Celia a question, her eyes dreadfully serious.
May I have a caramel apple?
She asks.
I'm out of popcorn,
Widget complains, holding out his empty bag. Celia takes the bag from him and folds it up into ever smaller squares while the twins watch until it disappears completely. When they clap, Widget's hands are no longer covered in caramel, though he does not notice. Celia considers the twins for a moment, while Widget tries to figure out where the popcorn bag has gone, and Poppet casts thoughtful glances up at the sky. It is not a good idea. She knows it is not a good idea, but it would be better to keep them close, to watch them more carefully given the circumstances and their apparent talents. Would the two of you like to learn how to do things like that? Celia asks them. Widget nods immediately with such enthusiasm that his hat slips forward over his eyes. Poppet hesitates, but then she nods as well. Then, when you are a little bit older, I shall give you lessons.
But it will have to be our secret, Celia says.
Can you two keep a secret?
The twins nod in unison. Widget has to straighten his hat again. They follow Celia happily as she leads them back to the courtyard. Wishes and Desires, Paris, May 1891. When the beaded curtain parts with a sound like rain, it is Marco who enters the fortune-teller's chamber, and Isabel immediately flips her veil from her face, the impossibly thin black silk floating back over her head like mist.
"What are you doing here?"
she asks.
"Why didn't you tell me about this?"
Ignoring her question, he holds out an open notebook, and in the flickering light, Isabel can discern a bare black tree.
"It is not like the trees that are inscribed in so many of his books. This one is covered in dripping white candles."
Surrounding the main drawings are detailed sketches of twisting branches, capturing several different angles.
"That's the wishing tree," Isabel says. "It's new."
"I know it's new," Marco says. "Why didn't you tell me about it?"
"I haven't had time to write you," Isabel says. "And I wasn't even sure whether or not it was something you had done yourself. It seemed like something you might have made. It's lovely, the way wishes are added to it, by lighting candles with ones that are already lit, and adding them to the branches. New wishes ignited by old wishes."
"It's hers," Marco says simply, pulling the notebook back.
"How can you be certain?"
Isabel asks. Marco pauses, looking down at the sketch, annoyed that he could not properly capture the beauty of the thing in hastily rendered drawings.
"I can feel it," he says.
"It is like knowing that a storm is coming, the shift in the air around it. As soon as I walked into the tent, I could sense it, and it is stronger, closer to the tree itself. I'm not certain it would be perceptible if one were unfamiliar with such sensation."
"Do you think she can feel what you do in the same way?" Isabel asks.
Marco has not considered this before, though it seems it would be true. He finds the idea strangely pleasing.
"I do not know," is all he says to Isabel.
Isabel pushes the veil that is slipping over her face back behind her head again.
"Well," she says, "now you know about it, and you can do whatever you want to it."
"It doesn't work that way," Marco says. "I cannot use anything she does for my own purposes. The sides need to remain separate. If we were playing a game of chess, I could not simply remove her pieces from the board. My only option is to retaliate with my own pieces when she moves hers."
"But there can't possibly be an end game then," Isabel says.
"How can you checkmate a circus? It doesn't make any sense."
"It's
Not like chess, Marco says, struggling to explain something that he has finally begun to understand, even though he cannot properly articulate it. He glances at her table where a few cards remain laid face up, one in particular catching his attention.
It's like this, he says, pointing out the woman with her scales and sword, La Justice inscribed below her feet.
It's a set of scales. One side is mine, the other is hers. A set of silver scales appears on the table between the cards, balancing precariously, each side piled with diamonds that sparkle in the candlelight.
So the object is to tip the scales in your favor? Isabel asks.
Marco nods, turning through the pages of his notebook. He keeps flipping back to the page with the tree.
But if you both keep adding to your sides of the scale, increasing the weight on each side in turn, Isabel says, watching the gently swaying scale, won't it break?
I do not believe it is an exact comparison, Marco says, and the scales vanish. Isabel frowns at the empty space.
How long is this going to go on? She asks.
I have no idea, Marco says.
Do you want to leave? He adds, looking up at her, unsure of what response he wants to the question.
No, Isabel says. I don't want to leave. I like it here, I do. But I would also like to understand. Maybe if I understood better, I could be more helpful.
You are helpful, Marco says.
Perhaps the only advantage I have is that she does not know who I am. She only has the circus to react to, and I have you to watch her.
But I haven't seen any reaction, Isabel protests. She keeps to herself. She reads more than anyone I have ever met. The Murray twins adore her. She has been nothing but kind to me. I have never seen her do a single thing out of the ordinary beyond when she performs. You say she is making all these moves, and yet I never see her do anything. How do you know that tree is not Ethan Barris's work?
Mr. Barris creates impressive mechanics, but this is not his doing. Though she's embellished his carousel, I'm certain of that. I doubt even an engineer of Mr. Barris's talent can make a painted wooden griffin breathe. That tree is rooted in the ground. It is a living tree, even if it does not have leaves. Marco turns his attention back to his sketch, tracing the lines of the tree with his fingertips.
Did you make a wish?
Isabel asks quietly. Marco closes his notebook without answering the question.
Does she still perform on the quarter hour? He asks, drawing a watch from his pocket.
Yes, but you're going to sit there and watch her show? Isabel asks. There's barely room for 20 people in her tent. She'll notice you. Won't she think it's strange that you're here?
She won't even recognize me, Marco says. The watch vanishes from his hand. Whenever there is a new tent, I would appreciate it if you would let me know. He turns and walks away, moving so quickly that the candle flames shiver with the motion of the air.
I miss you,
Isabel says as he leaves, but the sentiment is crushed by the clatter of the beaded curtain falling closed behind him. She tugs the black mist of her veil back down over her face. After the last of her querents has departed in the early hours of the morning, Isabel takes her Marseille deck from her pocket. She carries it with her always, though she has a separate deck for circus readings, a custom-made version in black and white and shades of grey. From the Marseille deck, she draws a single card. She knows which it will be before she turns it over. The angel emblazoned on the front is only a confirmation of what she already suspects. She does not return it to the deck. Atmosphere. London, September 1891. The circus has arrived near London, the train creeping in just after nightfall without drawing any notice. The train cars collapse, doors and halls sliding apart, silently forming chains of windowless rooms. Canvas stripes unfurl around them, uncoiled ropes snapping taut, and platforms assembling themselves amongst carefully draped curtains. The company assumes there is a crew that accomplishes this feat while they unpack their trunks, though some aspects of the transition are clearly automated. This was once the case, but now there is no crew, no unseen stagehands moving bits of scenery to their proper places. They are no longer necessary. The tents sit quiet and dark, as the circus will not be open to the public until the following evening. While most of the performers are spending the night in the city, visiting old friends and favorite pubs, Celia Bowen sits alone in her backstage suite. Her rooms are modest in comparison to others hidden behind the circus tents, but they are filled with books and well-worn furniture. Mismatched candles burn merrily on every available surface, illuminating the sleeping doves in their cages, hanging amongst sweeping curtains of richly colored tapestries. A cozy sanctuary, comfortable and quiet. The knock on the door comes as a surprise.
"Is this how you intend to spend your entire night?" Tsukiko asks, glancing at the book in Celia's hand. "I take it you came to suggest an alternative?" Celia asks. The contortionist does not often visit solely for the sake of visiting. "I have a social engagement, and I thought you might join me," Tsukiko says. "You spend too much time in solitude."
Celia attempts to protest, but Tsukiko is insistent, taking out one of Celia's finest gowns, one of few with any color, a deep blue velvet embellished with pale gold.
"Where are we going?"
Celia asks, but Tsukiko refuses to say. It is too late an hour for their destination to be the theater or the ballet. Celia laughs when they arrive at La Maison Lefebvre.
"You could have told me," she says to Tsukiko. "Then it would not have been a surprise," Tsukiko responds.
Celia has attended only a single function at La Maison Lefebvre, and that was more pre-circus opening reception than proper midnight dinner. But despite visiting the house on only a handful of occasions between her audition and the opening of the circus, she finds she is already acquainted with each of the guests. Her arrival with Tsukiko is a surprise to the rest of them, but she is greeted warmly by Chandresh and swept into the parlor with a glass of champagne in her hand before she can apologize for her unexpected presence.
"See that they set an additional place for dinner," Chandresh says to Marco, before taking her on a cursory spin around the room to make sure she has met everyone.
Celia finds it odd that he does not seem to remember. Madame Parva is gracious as always, her gown the warm copper of autumn leaves glowing in the candlelight. The Burgess sisters and Mr. Barris have apparently already been making light of the fact that the three of them have all worn various shades of blue, an unplanned detail, and Celia's gown is cited as proof that it must simply be in fashion. There is some mention of another guest that may or may not be attending, but Celia does not catch his name. She feels slightly out of place in this gathering of people who have known each other for so long. But Tsukiko makes a point of including her in the conversation, and Mr. Barris pays such attention to her every word when she does speak that Lainey begins to tease him about it. While Celia knows Mr. Barris quite well, having met with him several times and exchanged dozens of letters, he does an impressive job of pretending they are mere acquaintances.
"You should have been an actor," she whispers to him when she is certain no one will overhear.
"I know,"
he replies, sounding genuinely sad. "Such a shame that I miss my true calling."
Celia has never spoken with either of the Burgess sisters at much length. Lainey is more talkative than Tara, and tonight she learns in greater detail the touches that they have put on the circus. While Madame Padva's costumes and Mr. Barris's feats of engineering are obvious, the mark of the Burgess sisters is more subtle, though it permeates almost every aspect of the circus. The scents, the music, the quality of the light, even the weight of the velvet curtains at the entrance. They have arranged each element to appear effortless.
"We like to hit all of the senses," Lainey says.
"Some more than others,"
Tara adds.
"True," her sister agrees. "Scent is often underestimated when it can be the most evocative." They are brilliant with atmosphere,
Chandrish remarks to Celia as he joins their conversation, switching her empty glass of champagne with a freshly poured replacement.
Both of them, absolutely brilliant. The trick is to make it seem as though none of it is purposeful,
Lainey whispers,
to make the artificial feel natural. To tie all the elements together,
Tara finishes. It seems to Celia that they provide a similar service within the present company. Celia doubts that these gatherings would have continued so long after the circus began without the Burgess sisters' infectious, bubbling laughter. They ask the perfect questions to keep the conversation flowing, warding off any lulls. And Mr. Barris provides an ideal contrast, serious and attentive, keeping the dynamic of the group in balance. A movement in the hall catches Celia's eye, and while anyone else might have credited a number of candles or mirrors for the reflection, she knows the cause immediately. She steps out into the hall unnoticed, slipping out of sight into the shadowed library across from the parlor. It is lit only by a panel of stained glass stretching in a glowing sunset along one wall, sending its warm hue cascading over the closest shelves and letting the rest of the room fall into shadow.
Can I not have one evening to enjoy myself without you following me?
Celia whispers into the darkness.
I do not think social engagements of this sort are a proper use of your time,
her father replies, the sunset light catching part of his face and the front of his shirt in a distorted column of red.
You do not get to dictate how I spend every moment of my time, Papa. You are losing your focus,
Hector replies.
I cannot lose my focus, Celia says. Between new tents and embellishments, I actively control a significant part of the circus, which is closed at the moment, if you hadn't noticed. And the better I know these people, the better I can manipulate what they've already done. They created it, after all.
I suppose that is a valid point, Hector says.
Celia suspects he is scowling despite the admission, though it is too dark to tell.
But you'd do well to remember that you have no reason to trust anyone in that room.
Leave me alone, Papa,
Celia says, and sighs. Miss Bowen? A voice says behind her, and she turns, surprised to find Chandrish's assistant standing in the doorway watching her. Dinner is about to begin. If you would care to join the rest of the guests in the dining room?
My apologies,
Celia says, her eyes darting back to the shadows. But her father has vanished. I was distracted by the size of the library. I did not think anyone would notice I was missing.
I am certain that they would, Marco says, though I have been distracted by the library myself many times.
The charming smile that accompanies the statement catches Celia off guard, as she has rarely seen anything but varying degrees of reserved attentiveness or occasional nervousness on his countenance.
Thank you for coming to fetch me,
she says, hoping that dinner guests talking to themselves while supposedly perusing books without the aid of proper lighting is not an unusual occurrence at La Maison Lefebvre.
They likely suspect you vanished into thin air,
Marco responds as they walk through the hall.
I thought perhaps that was not the case.
He holds each door open for her as he escorts her to the dining room. Celia is seated between Chandresh and Tsukiko.
This is preferable to spending the evening alone, is it not?
Tsukiko asks, smiling when Celia admits that it is true. As the courses progress, when she is not distracted by the astounding quality of the food, Celia makes a game of deciphering the relationships between the guests, reading the way they interact, intuiting the emotions hidden beneath the laughter and conversation, catching the places that gazes linger. Chandresh's glances at his handsome assistant grow more obvious with each glass of wine, and Celia suspects Mr. Alistair is well aware of it, though Marco remains a quiet presence at the edge of the room. It takes her three courses to determine which of the Burgess sisters Mr. Barris favours, but by the time the artfully arranged plates of what appear to be whole pigeons spiced with cinnamon arrive, she is certain though she cannot tell if Lainey herself knows. Madame Padva is called Tunt by the entire company, though she feels more like a matriarch than merely an aunt. When Celia addresses her as Madame, everyone turns to look at her in surprise.
"So proper for a circus girl," Madame Padva says, with a gleam in her eye. "We shall have to loosen those corset laces if we intend to keep you as intimate dinner company."
"I expected the corset unlacing would take place after dinner," Celia says mildly, earning a chorus of laughter.
"We shall be keeping Miss Bowen as intimate company regardless of the state of her corset," Chandrish says. "Make a note of that," he adds, waving a hand at Marco.
"Miss Bowen's corset is duly noted, sir," Marco replies, and the laughter bubbles over the table again. Marco catches Celia's glance with a hint of the smile from earlier before he turns away, fading into the background again almost as easily as her father vanishes into shadows. The next course arrives, and Celia returns to listening and observing, in between trying to figure out if the meat, disguised in feather-like pastry and delicate wine sauce, is actually lamb or something more exotic. There is something about Tara's behavior that Celia finds bothersome, something almost haunted in her expression that comes and goes. One moment she is actively engaged in the conversation, her laugh echoing her sister's, and the next, she seems distant, staring through the dripping candles. It is only when the echoed laugh sounds almost like a sob for a moment that Celia realizes that Tara reminds her of her mother. The dessert course halts the conversation entirely. Globes of thinly blown sugar sit on each plate and must be broken open in order to access the clouds of cream within. After the cacophony of shattering sugar, it does not take long for the diners to realize that, though the globes appeared identical, each of them has been presented with an entirely unique flavor. There is much sharing of spoons, and while some are easily guessed as ginger with peach or curried coconut, others remain delicious mysteries. Celia's is clearly honey, but with a blend of spices beneath the sweetness that no one is able to place. After dinner, the conversation continues over coffee and brandy in the parlor until an hour most of the guests deem extremely late, but Tsukiko points out that it is comparatively early for the circus girls. When they do begin to say their goodbyes, Celia is embraced no differently than anyone else and given several invitations to meet for tea while the circus remains in London. "Thank you," she says to Tsukiko as they leave. "I enjoyed that more than I had expected to." "The finest of pleasures are always the unexpected ones," Tsukiko replies. Marco watches from the window as the guests depart, catching a last glimpse of Celia before she disappears into the night. He does a round through the parlor and dining room, and then downstairs to the kitchens to make certain everything is in order. The rest of the staff has already departed. He extinguishes the last of the lights before ascending several flights to check on Chandresh.
"Brilliant dinner tonight, don't you think?"
Chandresh asks when Marco reaches the suite that comprises the entire fifth story, each room lit by a multitude of Moroccan lanterns that cast fractured shadows over the opulent furniture.
"Indeed, sir," Marco says.
"Nothing on the agenda for tomorrow, though, or later today, whatever time it is?"
"There is the meeting in the afternoon regarding next season's ballet schedule."
"Ah, I had forgotten," Chandrish says. "Cancel that, would you?"
"Of course, sir,"
Marco says, taking a notebook from his pocket and marking down the request.
"Oh, and order a dozen cases of whatever that brandy was that Ethan brought. Marvelous stuff, that."
Marco nods, adding it to his notes.
"You're not leaving, are you?"
Chandrish asks.
"No, sir,"
Marco says. "I had thought it too late to be going home."
"Home,"
Chandrish repeats, as though the word sounds foreign.
"This is your home as much as that flat you insist on keeping is. More so, even."
"I shall endeavor to remember that, sir,"
Marco says.
Miss Bowen is a lovely woman, don't you think?
Chandrish remarks suddenly, turning to gauge the reaction to the question. Caught by surprise, Marco only manages to stammer something he hopes resembles his standard impartial agreement.
We must invite her to dinner whenever the circus is in town, so we might get to know her better.
Chandrish says pointedly, emphasizing the statement with a satisfied grin.
Yes, sir,
Marco says, struggling to keep his expression impassive. Will that be all for tonight? Chandrish laughs as he waves him away. Before he retires to his own rooms, a suite three times the size of his flat, Marco quietly returns to the library. He stands for some time in the spot where he found Celia hours before, scrutinizing the familiar bookshelves and the wall of stained glass. He cannot guess what she might have been doing, and he does not notice the eyes staring at him from the shadows. Revers, 1891-1892. Herr Friedrich Thiessen receives the card in the mail, a plain envelope amongst his invoices and business correspondence. The envelope holds no letter or note, simply a card that is black on one side and white on the other. Le Cirque des Rêves is printed on the front in silver ink. On the back, handwritten in black ink, on white, it reads, 29 September, just outside Dresden, Saxony. Herr Thiessen can barely contain his glee. He makes arrangements with his clients, finishes his clocks in progress in record time, and secures a short-term flat rental in Dresden. He arrives in Dresden on September 28 and spends the day wandering the outskirts of the city, wondering where the circus might set up. There is no indication of its impending arrival, only a slight electricity in the air. Though Herr Thiessen is unsure if anyone, save himself, can sense it, he feels honored at having been given advance notice. On September 29, he sleeps in, anticipating the late night ahead. When he leaves his flat in the early afternoon to find something to eat, the streets are already buzzing with the news. A strange circus has appeared overnight, just west of the city. A gargantuan thing with striped tents, they are saying when he reaches the pub. Never seen anything like it. Herr Thiessen stays silent on the matter, enjoying the excitement and curiosity around him. Shortly before sunset, Herr Thiessen heads west, finding the circus easily as there is a large crowd assembled outside already. While he waits with the crowd, he wonders how the circus manages to set up so quickly. He is certain that the field it sits in now, as though it has always been there, had been empty the day before when he walked around the city. The circus has simply materialized.
Like magic,
he overhears someone remark, and Herr Thiessen has to agree. When the gates open at last, Herr Friedrich Thiessen feels as though he is returning home after an extended absence. He spends almost every night there, and during the day, he sits in his rented flat or at the pub with a glass of wine and a journal, and he writes about it. Pages and pages of observations, recounting his experiences. Mostly so he will not forget them, but also to capture something of the circus on paper. Something he can hold on to. He occasionally converses about the circus with his fellow pub dwellers. One of these is a man who edits the city paper, and after some persuading and several glasses of wine, he manages to get Friedrich to show him the journal. After a shot or two of bourbon, he convinces Friedrich to allow excerpts of it to be published in the newspaper. The circus departs Dresden in late October, but the newspaper editor keeps his word. The article is well received, and followed by another, and then another. Herr Thiessen continues to write, and over the following months, some of the articles are reprinted in other German papers, and eventually they are translated and printed in Sweden and Denmark and France. One article finds its way into a London paper, printed under the title Nights at the Circus. It is these articles that make Herr Friedrich Thiessen the unofficial leader, the figurehead, of those most ardent followers of the circus. Some are introduced to Le Cirque des Rêves through his writing, while others feel an instant connection with him as they read his words, an affinity for this man who experiences the circus as they do, as something wondrous and inimitable. Some seek him out, and the meetings and dinners that follow herald the formation of a kind of club, a society of lovers of the circus. The title of rêveur begins as a joke, but it sticks, secure in its appropriateness. Herr Thiessen enjoys this immensely, being surrounded by kindred spirits from all over Europe, and occasionally even farther, who will discuss the circus endlessly. He transcribes the stories of other rêveurs to include in his writings. He constructs small keepsake clocks for them depicting their favorite acts or performances. One of these is a marvel of tiny flying acrobats on ribbons, made for a young woman who spends most of her hours at the circus in that massive tent, staring upward. He even, somewhat unintentionally, starts a fashion trend amongst the rêveurs. He comments at a dinner in Munich, where many of the dinners are held near his home, though they are also held in London and Paris and countless other cities as well, that when he attends the circus, he prefers to wear a black coat, to better blend in with his surroundings and feel a part of the circus. But with it, he wears a scarf in a brilliant scarlet, to distinguish himself from it as well, as a reminder that he is at heart a spectator, an observer. Word spreads quickly in such select circles, and so begins a tradition of rêveurs attending Le Cirque des Rêves, decked in black or white or grey, with a single shock of red, a scarf or hat, or, if the weather is warm, a red rose tucked into a lapel or behind an ear. It is also quite helpful for spotting other rêveurs, a simple signal for those in the know. There are those who have the means, and even some who do not but creatively manage anyway, to follow the circus from location to location. There is no set itinerary that is public knowledge. The circus moves from place to place every few weeks, with the occasional extended break, and no one truly knows where it might appear until the tents are already erected in a field, in a city, or the countryside, or somewhere in between. But there are those few people, select rêveurs, who are familiar with the circus and its ways, who have made polite acquaintance of the proper individuals, and are notified of impending locations, and they in turn notify others in other countries, in other cities. The most common method is subtle, and works both in person and by post. They send cards, small rectangular cards, much like postcards, that vary but are always black on one side and white on the other. Some use actual postcards, others choose to make their own. The cards state simply, "The circus is coming," and list a location. Sometimes there is a date, but not always. The circus functions in approximations more than exacting details, but the notification and location is often enough. Most rêveurs have a home base and prefer not to travel terribly far. Rêveurs who call Canada home may be hesitant to travel to Russia, but easily make extended visits to Boston or Chicago, while those in Morocco may travel to many destinations in Europe, but perhaps not all the way to China or Japan. Some, though, follow the circus wherever it may lead, through money or luck or extensive favors from other rêveurs. But they are all rêveurs, each in their own way, even those who only have the means to visit the circus when it comes to them, rather than the other way around. They smile when they spot each other. They meet up at local pubs to have drinks and chat while they wait impatiently for the sun to set. It is these aficionados, these rêveurs, who see the details in the bigger picture of the circus. They see the nuance of the costumes, the intricacy of the signs. They buy sugar flowers and do not eat them, wrapping them in paper instead and carefully bringing them home. They are enthusiasts, devotees, addicts. Something about the circus stirs their souls, and they ache for it when it is absent. They seek each other out, these people of such specific like mind, They tell of how they found the circus, how those first few steps were like magic, like stepping into a fairy tale under a curtain of stars. They pontificate upon the fluffiness of the popcorn, the sweetness of the chocolate. They spend hours discussing the quality of the light, the heat of the bonfire. They sit over their drinks smiling like children, and they relish being surrounded by kindred spirits, if only for an evening. When they depart, they shake hands and embrace like old friends, even if they have only just met, and as they go their separate ways, they feel less alone than they had before. The circus knows of them and appreciates them. Often someone approaching the ticket booth in a black coat with a red scarf will be waved in without paying admission, or given a mug of cider or bag of popcorn gratis. Performers spotting them in the audience will bring out their best tricks. Some of the revelers wander the circus continuously, methodically visiting every tent, watching each performance. Others have their favorite spots which they rarely leave, choosing to pass the entire night in the menagerie or the Hall of Mirrors. They are the ones who stay the latest, through the small hours when most visitors have gone to seek their beds. Often, just before dawn, there is no color to be seen in Le Cirque des Rêves save for their small splashes of scarlet. Herr Thiessen receives dozens of letters from other rêveurs, and he responds to each. While some remain single letters, content with their one-time replies, others evolve into longer exchanges, collections of ongoing conversations. Today, he is replying to a letter he finds particularly intriguing. The author writes about the circus with stunning specificity, and the letter is more personal than most, delving into thoughts on his own writings, observations about his Wunschtraum clock containing a level of detail that would require observing it for hours on end. He reads the letter three times before he sits at his desk to compose his reply. The postmark is from New York, but he does not recognize the signature as belonging to any of the rêveurs he has met in passing in that or any other city. "Dear Miss Bowen," he begins. He hopes that he will receive another letter in turn.
Collaborations, September to December 1893. Marco arrives at Mr. Barris's London office only a few minutes before his scheduled appointment, surprised to find the normally well-ordered space in near Bedlam, full of half-packed crates and stacks of boxes. The desk is nowhere to be seen, buried beneath the chaos.
"Is it that late already?"
Mr. Barris asks when Marco knocks on the open door, unable to step inside due to a lack of available floor.
"I should have left the clock out. It's in one of those crates."
He waves at a line of large wooden crates along the wall, though if one of them is ticking, it is impossible to tell.
"And I meant to clear a path as well,"
he adds, pushing boxes aside and picking up piles of rolled blueprints. "Sorry to intrude," Marco says. "I wanted to speak with you before you left the city. I would have waited until you were settled again, but I thought it best to discuss the matter in person."
"Of course," Mr. Barris says. "I wanted to give you the spare copies of the circus plans. They are around here somewhere."
He sifts through the pile of blueprints, checking labels and dates. The office door closes quietly, untouched.
"May I ask you a question, Mr. Barris?" Marco inquires.
"Certainly,"
Mr. Barris says, still sorting through rolls of paper. "How much do you know?"
Mr. Barris puts down the blueprint in his hand and turns, pushing his spectacles up on the bridge of his nose to better regard Marco's expression.
"How much do I know about what?"
he asks after the pause has gone on too long.
"How much has Miss Bowen told you?" Marco asks in response.
Mr. Barris looks at him curiously for a moment before he speaks.
"You're her opponent,"
he says, a smile spreading across his face when Marco nods.
"I never would have guessed."
"She told you about the competition," Marco says.
"Only in the most basic of terms,"
Mr. Barris says,
She came to me several years ago and asked what I might say if she were to tell me that everything she does is real. I told her that I would have to take her at her word or think her a liar, and I would never dream such